You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, May 30th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
The blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Before we really get going this week, there's a brief but important announcement. Many, if not all of you, will have received an email from the old Northwest Net email address Harold used to operate the party up until his death. It had always been my intention to avoid reusing that address, but it would be necessary from time to time. And yes, that really is us, and yes, we are attempting to reestablish contact with all of those interested. This may seem horribly timed and as if it's taken far too long for us to accomplish. It turns out that's not the case, but I won't be explaining that this week. In about a month's time or so, you'll get to find out what's going on and why things are the way they are. Until then, just sit tight and check your email and follow any instructions therein if you so choose. Thank you. The last original content I submitted to Radio Free Northwest had to do with the issue of slavery, and during that segment I mentioned I would like to talk about the effect slavery had on the white population because this is the actual reason I'm opposed to slavery. This is particularly important because it has to do with the reason civilizations always end up failing when they go brown. I think you all know where I'm going with this, but it's worth spelling out. Again, since this came up in the comments, the resource I'm referencing is a book titled The South Was Right by brothers James Ronald Kennedy and Walter Donald Kennedy. I found it to be a fascinating read many, many years ago, and I've picked it up again to do these commentaries as needed. In a chapter regarding race relations both in the North and the South, a couple of very interesting facts are presented. Now, these facts are parallel in that they don't contradict each other, and they're actually congruent in that they go perfectly together. And more importantly, they're in line with the shocking moral nature of what really caused the events surrounding conflicts regarding slavery in this country. Fact number one is as follows. Slavery was by and large abolished in the North for the most part for a very interesting reason, and it's that the white labor force refused to put up with the competition. This is especially fascinating because the same event did not really happen in the South to the same degree, and there were consequences for that as well. The chapter to which I'm referring quotes many slaves and former slaves to help drive home the point that the standard history regarding race relations is absolutely a lie. None of these quotes is more shocking than this. A former slave named Elijah Hopkins apparently said, in slavery times, a poor white man was worse off than a nigger. His words. That very same paragraph quotes another source to indicate that one of the songs that slave children would sing is, I'd rather be a nigger than a poor white man. Combine this observation with the fact that the North largely abolished slavery simply because the white labor force wasn't going to put up with that sort of competition, and I think we all see what was really going on. As a reminder, what I'm really talking about today is about how slavery affects white society in general, not just this particular instance of slavery. I've also heard it said that across history, slaves were actually able, on average, to keep 80% of their earnings. That's a little bit shocking to me because your standard white American today who makes anything resembling the average household income has no chance at keeping 80% of their earnings. So American slaves, while very, very low in economic liberty, were actually very high in fiscal liberty, and modern white people are actually very high in economic liberty in that we can choose where we work, but we're very low in fiscal liberty because we don't actually get to keep as much of our earnings as historically, on average, slaves across the world did. The chapter I'm primarily focusing on today out of this book opened with the claim that at the time slavery was first instituted in the American colonies, it was considered perfectly acceptable simply because there wasn't enough labor to go around so that somebody had to do all the work. I find that difficult to believe for a couple of reasons, the first of which is a backdrop given to us by Harold Covington using his exhaustive knowledge of history in the Northwest Independence novels. Briefly, I'm going to read a selection from A Distant Thunder. Before I begin this reading from A Distant Thunder, I need to remind you that this particular book by Harold Covington was written from the first-person perspective of Shane Ryan. That becomes important in the text, as you'll see. Carter sat down and looked back at me. "That is horseshit, and don't you ever let me hear you say anything like that again, or I'll break your jaw," he said to me. My child's death was foreordained on the day 4 centuries ago when those morons at Jamestown traded 2 perfectly good barrels of sipping whiskey to some Dutchman in exchange for 20 niggers. Bad deeds have consequences. And especially vile and evil deeds have especially vile and evil consequences. And sometimes they even go beyond the 7th generation the Bible commands that the sins of the fathers must be atoned for. Generation after generation of our people have lived out their lives as disgusting cowards who left this job to be done and this bill to be paid by us. May they burn in hell. You and me just paid another jot on that divine tab that we never run up, and we're gonna pay more before it's done. But somebody has to pay that tab. God will not be mocked. He will not be cheated of his due. He will no longer give the white race a free lunch. The reckoning for our weakness and our sloth and our cowardice as a race will be paid, and all the damnable, heart-wrenching, and soul-destroying interest that goes with it. Because until the scales are balanced, nothing good can ever come again in the world. That segment of A Distant Thunder, again by Harold Covington, is Carter Wingfield of the NVA discussing the death of his daughter, Rooney Wingfield, at the hands of the occupying forces during the campaign for liberation of the Northwest American Republic. Harold said it repeatedly, and I'll say it again here because it's necessary, his novels were first and foremost ideological instruction manuals. Not necessarily literal instruction manuals, though. Their actual purpose was to demonstrate the type of person necessary to bring about the creation of the Northwest American Republic, and the attitude displayed by Carter Wingfield illustrates precisely what's actually wrong with slavery. I don't care one lick about what it did to the niggers, I care about what it does to the society of white people that engage in it. And the North seemingly copped on a little bit better than the South did, although I'm certain plenty of people in the South were well aware of this. Slavery undercuts the actual market value of labor, and yes, labor has a market value. Now, no, that does not make me a communist. Merely acknowledging that we have to have people to do work to keep an economy running is not any sort of ideological deviation from National Socialism. Bear in mind, National Socialism started as the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Just keep that in mind. If we want to be true National Socialists, we have to understand that laborers in society of all stripes definitely have a place, and it's wrong to undercut them. That is the actual cause of the Civil War, is what it seems, is that everybody was trying to jockey for who gets to undercut the laborers of the South. Is it going to be the rich plantation owners that were employing people who should never have been on this continent, or was it going to be the rich Yankee who was going to force the Southern states into absolute servitude? And with that said, I note that I've run a little bit longer than I intended to here, and Jason informs me he has other material, so I'm going to stay some commentary for next time I'm on. Even so, one of the most important things to point out here is that those claiming slavery was necessary for a particular period in the colonies pretty clearly were the extremely wealthy white people that could afford to buy slaves en masse, simply because we know what happened in the colony that turned into Plymouth, Massachusetts, where they had a commune that didn't work out, and as soon as everybody pitched in as was necessary, there was plenty to go around. I very, very much think this suggestion that slavery was necessary for any period in American history is quite a bit like the suggestion that, oh, there aren't enough white people having children, we've got to replace the population. Well, it's because you made it that way. ¶¶
evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing A Global Coup by Guillaume Fay. Now, this is a book that was written apparently back in the early aughts, and it critiques the neocons. Now, I have to admit that I've read a lot of Fay, and with this book in particular, I've begun to worry about a certain inadvertent spaced repetition, because as I got into this book, it did seem rather familiar to me. So I fear that I may have talked about this book in the past. However, Fay's work is always filled with gravitas, and so I'll try to look at this book with fresh eyes if that is in fact the case. Now, this author wants to analyze the use and the origins of the neocon movement. Now, like so many French, if you remember that time frame at all, or if you've researched that time frame, Fay was livid about the aggressive nature of the second Bush administration. The author explains this notion of deficiency of sovereignty. And this happens when there is the regime, possibly a regime that was supported by the United States, that has outlived its usefulness for these neocons. And at that point, they talk about various human rights abuses by this regime, and they use that to dispose of the regimes. Fay argues that the real reason for this is to prevent multipolarism. And this is especially true after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the unification of the EU. These various chess pieces were maneuvered to create problems in Islamic territory, which then resulted in mass migration. And he sees this as a vehicle to weaken Europe from becoming really a superpower. At this point, this book was written around 2003, and he's looking towards China, and he's saying that by the year 2020, that China is going to become very powerful because they have all the manufacturing there now, they have all the rare minerals, the rare earth. And it's interesting to note how Trump has frequently spoken of trade deals with China and is very concerned about that. Now, when Fay looks at the United States, he sees it as a territory that really is very much in decline, and he sees it as a territory that could potentially shrink in size. When he looks at world government, he thinks that the world is eventually going to be governed in these very large blocks. One of them will be North America. There'll also be Latin America, East Asia, Africa, and Europe, and he sees Africa as remaining very poor. This is an author that, unlike some other French intellectuals, he's not anti-American per se, although he does obviously dislike neocons. But he compliments Americans in this, the rank-and-file Americans, and especially those who he says have a Southern mentality. And he does note that compared to European art, for example, he sees American art as being less decadent. He actually hopes that in the coming decades, some Americans will decide to relocate to Europe. And of course, this would help with the very low birth rate in Europe and the depopulation of the natives. This author is very much a fan of Pat Buchanan, not surprisingly. He talks about the religion of universalism and progress and sees it as a proselytizing ideal. And he does compare it to Islam, but still, even though he sees certain aspects of Americanism as similar to Islam, he sees American culture as essentially a veneer, the subculture of America. And this can be a distracting veneer, but it's really nothing more than just a very superficial style. On the other hand, he sees Islam as something that is simplistic, but it's not shallow or stupid. At the end of the day, Islam is a much greater threat to Europe. In this book, he criticizes individuals like Benoist, who tend to be identitarian, but at the same time very left-wing. And he talks about how Benoist dislikes America so much that he would rather see Muslims in Europe than see a McDonald's in Europe. And also, the author sees a conspiracy in all this Islamophilia that was going on, at least at that time, in the identitarian scene. And he sees that as being secretly influenced by the U.S. Secret Service, who had the ear of some of these identitarians. So he sees America as promoting this Islamitization of Europe. He also realizes that America, ironically, is not immune to Islam. He notes that there are many non-whites in America of different flavors, blacks, Latinos, and also possibly even Asians, who either are already Islamic or will and have converted to Islam. So he sees that as a metastasis in the colored world that is growing in the West. And needless to say, he's very concerned. He says that just because he rejects the warmongering of the second Bush administration, he says that doesn't mean that he's going to be a pacifist. Nor does he dislike all Republicans. For example, he says that he prefers the flavor of Republicanism that was subscribed to by President Nixon. But, of course, the unfortunate thing about the Nixon presidency, whatever its merits, unfortunately, it was very subsumed by scandal. And so, when you think of the Nixon presidency, it's pretty much all you can think of. Basically, his takeaway from this book is that while both Americanism and Islam, as I said, can be messianic, Islam is going to work against Europe, while Americanism is largely benign and certainly reversible. He also looks at Christianity and he sees something that's very much out of breath, as he puts it. And he sees also, as I said, America as something that's on the wane. And, of course, as I said, you also see his competition or his needling of Benoist in this book. The only downside, perhaps, of this book is that it's really become, in a way, somewhat dated. So I would call it more of a historical document at this point that really typifies a certain French reaction to the second Iraq war, the war that occurred obviously after 9/11. Perhaps there's an appropriateness in discussing this French author at this point, because obviously the situation in France, however the accident or the so-called accident happened, France unfortunately has really become such a cesspool of late that it's really quite sad, or it's beyond sad perhaps. So I hope you found this discussion interesting and hopefully not too repetitive. So again, this is A Global Coup by Guillaume Fay, and this is something that can be found on Amazon, as many of these books can. So have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
This it can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal. Somewhere my mind it breaks.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Ogallala, Nebraska. This morning I was coming through the Omaha area ahead of me when I was still in Iowa. Saw the horizon being lit up by nice bright flashes of light because it was in the early morning hours. had a pretty good thunderstorm and torrential downpour coming through Omaha. And as I got west of Lincoln, Nebraska, I come across not a whole lot, but a few semis that had, I don't know if somebody had nodded off at the wheel or if they had lost their visibility and ran off the road. They were stuck in the mud and one was getting winched out. For those of you that are actually going to go and make a scouting trip or your migration, watch out for those thunderstorms. While I was sitting here in Ogallala, one of our other trucks came through the same storm that rolled over the top of me while I was parked here in the truck stop. He ended up getting both sides of his windshield busted up and had cracks and hail hits all over the place. Yeah, he had an interesting day and had to shut it down here because he couldn't see where the heck he was going. Fortunately, it was daytime, so he just slowed it down to about 20 miles an hour and limped into here at the truck stop. For those of you that aren't used to this kind of stuff, I'd definitely be wary of those big thunderstorms. More than likely, you do have or should have the capability of having a weather app on your smartphone if you have one, or tablet, or laptop, or whatever, but be able to bring up weather radar. Usually the rain shows up in green, the snow shows up as blue, at least on the weather app that I have. And you really need to watch out for those areas of yellow and especially the red, because that means, yeah, it's pretty intense. So I definitely avoid the yellows and especially the red areas. While I was getting up to get going this morning, or whatever you want to classify it as, it's early the day after Memorial Day now, Tuesday, getting up to roll out of here and nice heavy thunderstorm come rolling over the top of me with a bunch of lightning and thunder and all that. So I figured, okay, fine, I'll just go and wait till it passes just in case there's hail in it. There wasn't, but you never know. That's your weather warning from the trucker this time around. I just left Ogallala, Nebraska here earlier this morning, and I'm now sitting over here in Rock Springs. Those of you in the eastern part of the country may not believe it, but it's still snowing out here in the Rockies. Yeah, I know, it's almost the beginning of June. It's after Memorial Day weekend, but came through Cheyenne this morning, climbed up the hill to go over Sherman Hill, and lo and behold, when I got to about Buford, there towards the top of the hill, no snowplows had been out yet. It was snowing lightly, then it turned into, by the time I made it to the top of the hill where the rest area is, there was about, oh, maybe 3-4 inches of snow on the ground. No trucks had slid off the road yet, but there was a bunch of people parked that were too much of a wuss to go and try it. I had to go and stop in the rest area to go and let the dog play in the snow. For those of you that are actually going to make the road trip to come out here, just be advised, it's still wintertime out here. Yep, higher elevations, it was probably about 7,500, 8,000 feet. The rest area is at 8,600. It gets up there in elevation, and the storm front came through and dropped some snow on the ground. It was snowing all the way over to about Walcott on the other side of Laramie and stuff. Everybody was driving fairly sanely, not being stupid and stuff. Stuff can happen. Over the weekend, I guess, I-25 up north of Cheyenne got about 4 inches of hail. Yes, I said hail. And yes, I did say 4 inches worth, because there's a news article out about it where people were just stopped on the freeway because they couldn't get any traction, I guess. So just be aware of that. The Rockies are a whole different situation from you Easterners and Southerners are used to. It can get real interesting out here out west in the higher elevations in these little itty-bitty hills we call the Rockies. Just be advised, everybody. Hope to see you out here on the road making your scouting trips and, better yet, your migration here soon. All right, this is the trucker signing off from Wyoming.
Well, I'm down 18-wheeler rolling. We're going to do what they say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just to watch a bandit run.
Hello everyone, Comrade Jason here. It's an absolutely beautiful spring day here in the Puget Sound area of the homeland. Naturally, I shouldn't have to tell you that, because you should already be here so you could see it for yourselves. I want to provide you with an important party update. This week, the headquarters group re-established regular email contact with everyone on the Northwest Front distribution lists using the party's official email, nwnet@earthlink.net. Things have now advanced to the point where we will soon be able to become more active and visible again, and going forward, you should expect to hear from us on a fairly regular basis. The Northwest Observer that Harold managed to reliably put out will not return anytime soon. I know we all enjoyed thoroughly receiving this quite special and welcome original publication of Harold's writings and those of the many excellent guest writers he featured, some of whom, by their email responses this week, confirmed to me that they are still within our ranks, and whom I know are listening now. Hopefully we will have a means for you to continue your contributions and use your writing talents in the future. But the good news is that once again, email is reestablished. If you have not seen this email from us, check your spam folders. If you have not received it in any folder, then you are not on our email lists. If you would like to be, just email us at nwnet@earthlink.net and we will add you. For Andy's RFN this week, I have the next to last segment of the long-running America panel discussion that we have been playing for you the last few months. No additional commentary from me this time, but I will have the next show to put together, and of course plenty to say then. For now, I hope you find this segment valuable and enjoyable. Here it is. One of the things the NAR is going to have to grapple with, and we've talked about a bit, is the corruption of intent. Once again, successive generations changing what has been set up. Things evolve. Whatever is set up in all human endeavors, it has a natural life cycle akin to our life cycles of birth, growth, maximum vitality, and then several false recoveries on a downslope that falls off the cliff and dies.
True.
It's a natural birth and death life cycle of what seem to be of all human creations, because what you always have is, as time passes, the burst of energy, the burst of intent, the genius that allows something truly exceptional to come into new form. The people who created that and the circumstances under which it was created, those all change, those people go away. And the creators, as they leave the scene, they give up the scene to the managers and the people of lesser capability trying to maintain. And typically the people who move into positions of power after that, after a revolution, after something new has begun, are not of the same caliber as the men who began it and created it in the first place. So you'll always have this cycle of birth, maximum vitality, then decay, often with several false recoveries. This will happen to anything we set up as well. We need to, I think, have it in mind as we begin it, because you can set things up properly to alleviate the worst excesses of that if you understand that it's going to happen anyway and not have any illusions
yes.
about that.
Well,
so that's also part of our task.
I completely agree with you on that point. And you had stepped away briefly, but I made a point when I was reintroducing this that the one thing I have to reiterate is that when we are doing that, we must not make a compromise with something we know as death. We must not do what was done with the Constitution we live under now.
Granted,
and make a compromise with something we know will be its downfall.
I agree completely. I think that absolutely has to be the case. I'm not afraid of us doing that personally. And although I may not have the knowledge base that you have to, you know, feel comfortable characterizing the Constitutional Convention and everything in the same ways that you are, I have more to learn certainly on this.
The one thing I want to reiterate, and we've made it that this is just a historic fact, regardless of my opinions, regardless of the opinions of someone who would disagree with me, is that even if there's some good that came of it, that Constitutional Convention very quickly turned into a criminal enterprise according to the laws that were in place at the time. Now, are we proposing to do the same thing? In certain cases, absolutely. In some ways, yes.
As a characterization, yeah, I would say so.
That's true, but it's important to realize that that's a flat fact, and the difference is we're being honest about what we're talking about, and the myth of Americanism is that there was this great wonderful thing that happened when the actual history is it fell apart, and the result of it falling apart and everything failing is what we got.
I think one of the points to be made is as you create something new, as we would create something new, looking at the failures of the past and recognizing the potential for it all coming apart in successive generations, we do have to maybe not be as ambitious as we otherwise would want to be, because it will all change. And so we need to be very clear on the one, two, or three things that are utterly essential and cannot change over time. One of them obviously being the intent and purpose of the creation of an all-white nation state, a racial state, for the preservation of white people.
That is explicitly what Hitler said about the creation of National Socialist Germany, was the purpose of the state is to preserve the existence of the nation, And
exactly. We need to understand what that means. The word nation
is a biologically distinct
entity. Biologically distinct entity. And the word nation itself comes from the Latin. I forget which principal part of something or other of the, but the point is it's noscor nosci. You get down into one of the declensions in the word, and nation comes from that word, noscor nosci, which means to be born, which highlights the fact that a nation is a collection of people related by blood and lineage and the history and collective life that that represents. So this is the entire purpose. So when I'm talking about what we are going to create, what needs to be created in the future as a biological preserve for the world's greatest subspecies of humanity, the white subspecies, that is one of the unalterable things that must be provided for and could be provided for. And then, of course, our descendants will change things to suit themselves. But that is one of the things that can never change, and that can be provided for.
Yes.
Sanctions against perhaps speaking out against changing that character of that nation, maybe as an exception to the freedom of speech. And Don and I have some disagreements on whether that would be necessary. It could be that we would have an exception for freedom of speech. I'm a big freedom of speech guy. You will not silence me. I will get to speak to my fellow man the way I want. Thank you very much. And you will not stop me. I don't know. Maybe that could be one exception. Public agitation for changing the fundamental purpose of a white nation state, that could be the one exception to the rule for freedom of speech. Who knows?
Well, and it's worth noting that you're literally talking about committing national suicide at that point, as we're seeing all around us.
Exactly.
And because that affects everybody around you, you know, this is part of the reason that you have to have an all-white nation state, because the mixture, the presence of different races is what causes white genocide.
It's fundamental. It's biological.
And the issue is that why is race mixing not allowed? Because it affects everybody around you, even if you don't intend it to.
If you're going to go through the trouble of a revolution and creation of a new nation, allowing people to advocate the abolition of everything that you have created and everything that you've sweated and died for,
nope,
doesn't seem like something you should be able to do in that nation.
No, doubly so, because the only way that would happen is if we're successful and the continued existence of white people in and of itself is the evidence that that's right. You know, it's like all these shitskins all over the internet saying whatever they want to about white people, even when they're paid to say it as part of their job for whatever media outlet. The only way you can say that is because white people gave you the ability. We're not going to, you know, even the idea is silly. That's just one of my pet peeves. Anyway, most Americans still don't understand that they need to stop being Americans in order to keep being white. They don't understand. I get that they don't understand.
The way it is now, that is a choice that is being offered white people. You really can't maintain allegiance to the current state of America, because Donald Trump will move from the scene. The one remaining president loyal to America, he's going to move from the scene. And the disloyal Democrats who want the destruction of white people, they will be in charge from here on out. Do you guys recognize it? They will be in charge. Our enemies will be in charge of this nation's government from here on out. So you cannot be a loyal white man in the coming America. The future of America is non-white. It's biologically the reality right now. From K through 8th grade, it is now majority non-white in America. The last white child that was born in America as a majority was born in 2009. In 2010, that child was born as a minority in America if it was white. So you got to understand that. The future is non-white in America. You cannot be a loyal white man in coming America. You've got to give that up. If you're going to remain a loyal white man or woman, you've got to stop being an American.
Absolutely. We have been saying that for years. Don is giving that a thumbs up, by the way. We've been saying this for years, and it's important to understand. This is what we have to remind all of the newbies in the alt-right that they have plenty of potential to be white nationalists, but they are not. We've covered that a million times on RFN. One of those people, and several of those people later, in response to this material being re-aired some time ago, really, really got on our case. Granted, they're still in America mode, so they don't understand. I get that. But there's this propaganda coming from the alt-right that the founding felons were actually white nationalists because there was an Immigration Act of 1789 that forbade non-white immigration. Now, I talk an awful lot about some esoteric concepts, and one of those things is, again, this could be read religiously, but I don't think it has to, is discernment and standards. Now, standards are important because the standard for who is a white nationalist was very much tested by the alt-right, because so many of the clowns that the alt-right elevated ended up just referring to themselves as entertainers or media personalities, not leaders. And in fact, even Richard Spencer himself drunkenly tweeted that he was the leader of a movement and was forced to delete that about 30 seconds later. They all know that they're not leaders, but if you were to get down to the real reason for my dislike of the alt-right, it's that there was so much potential wasted there, but immediately my concern is this criticism of the Northwest Front that the founding felons were somehow white nationalists. Let's talk about standards. Okay, the alt-right very much tested the standard for who is and isn't a white nationalist, and shortly before his death, Harold and I had to go off on some kid on the internet because he challenged us and said that his merely being involved in the alt-right and giving mental assent to white nationalist ideas was moving white nationalism forward. But the idea that you being involved in some sort of psycho self-gratification is moving the movement forward, it's not true, and that's an absolutely low standard that has to be raised. Because as strange as it is for these same people to say that the founding fellows were white nationalists because of that one law, in certain senses, laws are just words. And the NF is characterized as not accepting words as making somebody part of us. And if you're at all interested in making an all-white ethnostate, which an awful lot of the alt-right is, an awful lot of the same people who would criticize me for calling out the founding felons, you need to understand that, okay, I just gave the rationale why you have to have an all-white ethnostate, because it will eventually lead to complete and total race chaos if you don't. But if that's true, then the founding felons also screwed up because they allowed all those slaves to stay even after they said, we don't want anybody who's not white.
Yeah, they were not up to guarding against what they damn well knew was going to be a problem in the future. There were some attempts made. The Colonation Society was formed. Madison was a part of that. Monroe was a part of that. Abraham Lincoln himself entertained the notion of finding a place for the blacks to go after they were freed. So yes. Even up until, you know, the schism and when America 1.0 died and 2.0 took its place,
yes.
And we're now in probably 2.5 running into America 3.0, which will die. The point is, even up until the 1860s, the white men of America, and there's some debate as to whether Lincoln was fully white, but you get what I'm saying. They were still understanding of this problem.
Negro equality? Fudge.
Yeah, they were not able to deal with it. You have to deal with it. You cannot kick the can so far down the road that the people who come after you forget that the can was a problem in the first place and allow it to stay around. What they did.
As much as I want to be supportive of new people in the alt-right, my real dislike of the alt-right, as I mentioned earlier, really has to do with the fact that the people who were running the show missed every important opportunity to do real education, because the alt-right, to its credit, there were several important, really basic ideas that got across, such as, you know, like very, very base level white nationalism. But because this was run by people who are political neophytes and thought that they don't need to listen to prior generations because they hate boomers and all this other stuff, you need to understand something about that. I'm a millennial myself. I have my opinions about boomers. My parents are boomers. I have relatives that are absolutely boomer as boomer can be, even though they're not the right age range. I think we all understand what that really means. The issue here is you can't compromise with something you know is wrong, because we see what the net result is. This is embarrassing. I'm blanking on the name. Wingfield, Carter Wingfield, from the Northwest Novels. He went on a short speech at one point, and he said, the conflict that he's a part of right now is paying the bill for hundreds of years of bad decisions on the part of his ancestors. And the faster we all understand that we can't vote our way out of this conflict, the faster we understand that American system politics will not allow us to survive, the better, because we need to get on with the business of paying that bill so that there are more of us in the future who don't have to pay it.
Agreed.
That's the goal here.
I would like to return so that Don can put in Don's commentary when I was talking about the possible exception to the freedom of speech. I'd like to hear your thoughts as to why we might be able to do without something like that, because like I said, I'm a huge freedom of speech guy. Would you like to readdress that and we'll just edit it in with your commentary?
Sure. I think we can afford and would benefit from unrestricted freedom of speech. People who use it to agitate against the state, it really is to our advantage to let them speak out so we know who they are. And intelligence services typically want to allow high-profile enemy agents to continue to operate in a high-profile manner so they can see whom they contact and so forth and so on. It won't hurt us. I don't think it'll hurt us at all. And I think supporting the principle of freedom of speech gives us a claim to the moral high ground. It makes the people who live, especially people who migrate, they are a good feeling that they make the right decision. And I think it has lots of positive benefits. And I don't see the downside. I don't think that allowing people to speak out is going to overturn the state. If it did, the state was weak to begin with.
As I think indicated, I'm of two minds about this for sure. That all makes perfect sense to me. It might very well be exactly the case. We need no restrictions whatsoever. Because you did make a point to me, which is, what has undermined that in America is active enemy agents, the Jews primarily amongst us, preying upon the weak-minded white people who can't really handle being the best. And I made this point a little earlier off mic. which is that not everyone in this world can handle being better than other people. Some people can't psychologically handle being out in front, being seen to be better. They can't handle the anticipated envy that they would face. It's a real psychological problem. And these people, if they get in positions of power, they can work to undermine the better in favor of the lesser. And that is the entire thing that communism, which is a Jewish creation designed to work off of envy, and these people who cannot measure up and cannot emotionally handle being better than others, their envy is stoked by communism, stoked by the Jew, to undermine us. So we do have to watch out for those people in society. But without that alien element you said before, we could sanitize ourselves sufficiently without the active alien Jew working in the shadows, having control of our media, hiding who he is and what he wants, right? That's basically what your point is. Without that, the white people would handle it without any real problems.
Well, yes. I don't totally see it that way, but there is merit to what these guys are saying. And I will say that so many of the issues that we would want to dampen or stamp out or whatever are related to morality and what's beneficial for the group. And it's worth noting that, as you say, in a healthy environment, morality is not necessarily about you not making a mistake, because mistakes are made, but it's about how the people around you react to you doing something wrong. And it could be a whole lot more manageable in a healthy environment to expect the community to rein in people's behavior in a way that's a whole lot more conducive to maintaining free speech. That is a possibility. I don't know how well that will play out, but I have to be completely honest and say that I cannot argue against it completely, simply on that basis.
You are adding another factor in here, and that is control. People controlling what they do, the state controlling what people do, their actions as opposed to their speech. That's opening, so to speak, another can of worms. But sure, I just don't see the benefit of censorship to a good state, to a functional state, to a stable state. It's only a threat to weak, unstable states. And in fact, to pick up on what you were saying, it's an admission of weakness. It happens when we allow the Jew in our society to subvert us. I think that an all-white ethno-state doesn't need censorship and doesn't benefit from censorship.
Censorship as such, no, I don't think we need it. Now, I will say again, this does come down to there is an issue of thought spurns word spurns action. I have a very large extended family, and here's where I have some reservations on this, is that when you offer people, especially children, multiple options, they will take whatever is perceived as easiest or the least troublesome for whatever they think is fun or interesting. And half of the trouble here is that we have to make sure that children have a completely sanitized environment, because so many of the problems we deal with right now can be dealt with effectively by healthy adults without government intervention. Here's the issue, is that so many of my extended family members ended up divorced due to having married, not just for petty reasons, thankfully, but divorced for, like, they married a monster. And these monsters proceeded to absolutely screw up their children. And these children, even though they were almost always, in fact, living with my relative rather than their other parent, they had a very hard time because they perceived there to be another authority giving them another option. And these non-relatives of mine seem to always contradict the other parent simply to spite them. What they did was basically remove all standards, and the kids had a very hard time deciding which is right because they both seem to be credible, but one person is saying drugs aren't a big deal, for example, and you can guess where that went.
Hmm.
You know, and this is, well, I guess I'm rambling now, but I want to point out that you absolutely have to make sure that children are not exposed to things that only adults can deal with. Because, as you say, censorship may not be necessary provided children are kept safe long enough to form adult opinions about the world before they're exposed to things that adults need to deal with. I guess that would be my only factor, is no corrupting the youth.
Yes, and I think in a properly healthy all-white nation, a racial state where all the population knows and understands and the mythos that is built around it supports completely that this is our purpose and we are unique in the world. Maybe we're unique, maybe we're not, maybe there are multiple white racial states around the world. Hopefully, that would be the case. The point is, we are constituted as a preserve for our unique people.
Mm-hmm.
That can be maintained, I think, pretty effectively, pretty easily, as distinct throughout the world. You will have this problem, though, with the people who can't handle being the best, because this kind of all-white racial state will be the best damn state in the fucking world.
Give it a chance, yes, it will be.
You know, pardon my French. Might edit that out, but It will be, and it is just the fact. The best always must deal with the worst, and we must effectively deal with the worst, otherwise we will be undermined by the worst in society, in any human enterprise. We have to figure out, we have to work it.
As indicated, this show is running longer than anticipated. Otherwise, I would have answered a very important email I was sent regarding a possible 51st state forming out of the eastern half of Washington. This was submitted to me by a local Bremerton comrade, and unfortunately, comrade, that's just how it shook out this time. That's a little bit too bad, since it would have gone very well with my other commentary today, but such is life. I'll get to it next time, I promise. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front. P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades, hail victory!
Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet thank God it still is beating perfectly.